Hello, we're Alex Rouget and Lee Chambers, and you're listening to a Bookmark podcast.
For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit the music chosen by our studio guest, but we hope you still enjoy the show.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark with me, Alex Rouget.
And me, Lee Chambers.
Bookmark is a programme about books and writing with a local slant. And in the studio today, we have local author Penny Hancock. We'll also be hearing from Richard Reynolds, the crime fiction expert at Heffers. I nearly said the crime expert, but that ain't, I don't think you would like that.
Exactly.
And also from...
Ruth Wade, who's a local crime writer.
Yes, yeah, so to start us off, we're going to have a chat about dark books, so books that explore the dark side of human nature, because I think Penny's books very much do this. So what are your favourite dark books?
Well, I'm not sure that favourite's the wrong word, is it? Because sometimes they're quite uncomfortable to read, but there were three that sprang to mind. American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis. I think that's probably the ultimate dark book, where you go inside somebody's head and it's very unpleasant. My Idea of Fun by Will Self, equally, it's sort of almost like the British version of that, and This Is How by MJ Hyland, which are all sort of inside the head of very disturbed individuals. And I find them completely fascinating, because your instinct as a reader is to sympathise or empathise with the person who's telling you the story, particularly if it's first person. So you end up being drawn into this kind of way of thinking and this weird world, and part of you then somehow wants this character sometimes to get away with it. And so it puts you in a very morally interesting place as a reader, that you almost feel you're collaborating or an accessory to these crimes that are going on. So I think as a device, as a writing device, it's really interesting. And as a writer, I mean, we talked to Penny about this, it must be quite challenging to make this person sympathetic, and how you sort of spin out that information so you make sure that the reader's well and truly hooked by the time you realise what a demon the person is. What about you?
Well, This Is How by MJ Hyland was one of mine as well. And I think what's so disturbing about that as well, she puts you so close to the narrator, who is the person who very early on in the book murders somebody, and he's such an ordinary character to begin with, and so it's so shocking. And then you continue to follow him through prison, and exactly what you were saying, it is very disturbing, but at the same time it's so clever the way they're able to do that and put you in that position. I've just read a book called After Me Comes the Flood, and by Sarah Perry, and that one not quite as dark as This Is How, but still it puts the reader with this strange character who gets drawn into this house full of even more strange characters, and the house itself is kind of spooky and these odd things happen, and I just loved it. And usually I don't like books that are really dark. I don't read Stephen King, but I certainly liked that feeling.
But that's a different kind of darkness, isn't it? Yeah. We're talking sort of psychological darkness, so it does play with your head a bit.
It does. But I kind of liked it. How about you, Penny?
I found that really interesting, what you said about psychological darkness, because I suppose what I'm interested in is the fact that we all potentially have that side to us. So when I write, I like to imagine somebody who could be you or I, who's actually not psychologically disturbed, but is maybe takes a step that leads them down a dark path, so that you can almost put yourself in their shoes and imagine it could be you. So I was thinking of examples of that, and I think Harriet Lane's new book, which is called Her, which is about two women. One's a young mother who's just struggling with her new baby and a toddler, and then a friend of hers who turns up from her school days, and you realise that this friend has got something against some kind of vendetta against this mother, and it's written from the two points of view, and you don't quite know who's going to end up being the worst or crossing the most lines. So that's the kind of scenario I find interesting.
Well, we're going to have some music before we introduce you properly, Penny. So your first track that we've got is The Kinks' Waterloo Sunset. Why have you chosen this?
I just chose that because I set all my books in London, and I just think it captures that beautiful kind of Thames scene above Waterloo Bridge when the sun's going down.
A lovely version of Waterloo Sunset there with the Kraut and Festival Choir. We are Bookmark and we're in the studio with Penny Hancock. Penny is a local author. She has written three novels, Tideline, The Darkening Hour, and her latest book is called A Trick of the Mind. Although she now lives in near Cambridge, Penny was born in Blackheath, and South East London and the River Thames feature heavily in her writing. Before becoming a full-time writer, Penny was a teacher, wrote articles and educational pieces. She joined the Creative Writing MA programme at Angela Ruskin. Is it in 2008? Is that right? 2009?
Can't remember. Can you remember, Lee? I was
on the same programme as people. Yeah. Yeah, I can never remember, no, because we graduated several years after we should have.
It was the first year. It was the first year of that creative writing programme, and she completed the first draft of Tideline. Tideline was chosen as Richard and Judy's summer read, and is, as author S.J. Watson describes, deliciously dark, brilliantly written and totally gripping, seeing a middle-aged woman take a teenage boy prisoner in her home. So, obviously, you do go to dark places in your writing, Penny. Why have you been attracted to this dark side of human nature, do you think?
Yeah, I often get asked that question. It's difficult. I think it's just because I'm a worrier, which maybe doesn't sort of sound immediately obvious, but I think when you worry about things a lot, you do kind of go down dark routes in your imagination. You kind of think of the worst case scenario. And I think it's that really that I like to kind of imagine people who cross lines and who kind of, instead of stopping somewhere with their obsessions, actually sort of go to the very sort of extreme lengths that those obsessions might take them to.
And you've always written sort of been, you know, as a hobby or, you know, what were you always writing that kind of story? Or
I think when I was little, going right back to the beginning, when I was at primary school, I had a really lovely, inspiring primary school teacher, and he used to encourage us to write about our playground games that we used to play. And for me, it was a real escape. It was escape from all those little things that you worry about as a child, about sort of friendships and anxieties about whatever you were worrying about at the time, illness or your parents dying, whatever. So it was a kind of escape, and I think that kind of set me off on that track of writing as a kind of a sort of solace, I suppose.
And then you wrote short stories a bit as well.
Yeah.
In the lead up.
I mean, again, you know, whenever something's bothering me, I usually try and think of a way of turning it into a story. I don't always. I mean, I forget to do that sometimes, but when I do, that always is a kind of way of making sense of things that aren't always very easy to make sense of. I did that from quite an early age.
And so tell us about Tideline, obviously without giving away the secrets of the book, but as your first book, tell us about that.
I mean, just generally all about it?
The main
sort of thrust of the story is about a middle-aged woman who kidnaps a teenage boy. And the idea came, and I was struggling with writing about a first love affair. I'd sort of bumped into somebody I'd gone out with when I was 16, totally by accident in Camden. He was in a shop, and it really kind of sparked off this intense feeling. I was in my 40s, I had kids, and but it really sort of suddenly brought back to me that intensity of first love. And so I was trying to write about that, and it wasn't really working. So in the end, when we were doing our crime module, I thought perhaps I could use that as a scenario for a crime story and think about a woman who was obsessed with this first love and then actually went to the lengths of sort of capturing a real boy.
And in Tideline, and actually in all your books, you write from the point of view of a perpetrator, somebody who does cross that line.
Yeah.
How do you get inside the head of somebody who's making those choices?
Well, again, as I said earlier, I think I'm not particularly interested in writing about psychopaths or extreme criminals. I'm much more interested in sort of writing about people that I know, usually sort of based on myself, and people I know who are close to me. So ordinary people, and just pushing that thing, you know, we all worry about things, we all become obsessed with things, and it's just that sort of taking it to the next step. And I think if if you're doing that, you are in the mind of that person. You are imagining, you're sort of living their life in a way. You're standing in their shoes, and in that, and so you become. I suppose once you're doing that, you're telling the story quite authentically, and that's what I do.
Always sounds, when writers talk about that, it sounds a little bit like method acting. You know, you're getting in their head.
Yes, in a way. Yeah.
And do you know when you've got the voice right? You know, when you're really inside that head.
I think so. I mean, sometimes. It takes a while to get that, but I think that's part of it for me, is trying to live in that person's shoes. Yeah, as you say, sort of like method acting. And sometimes, and I go to places and I try and sort of walk the routes that they would walk and so on. Yeah,
because people do say that about your work. You know, the place is a character, particularly in Tideline, the river and that area. And there's an amazing house in that novel as well. How did you how did you make that come alive on the page?
The house is partly a fantasy. I mean, I don't live in the house I would probably choose to live in if I had sort of, the endless funds. But houses mean a lot to me. I mean, I often dream about the house I grew up in, which was a big house in Blackheath. And so I think, you know, they have a strong impact on your kind of, on your psyche, I suppose, as you're growing up and as you grow older. And I wanted to recreate a house that I imagined would be my perfect house to live in. So the house in Tideline is it's a fantasy. It's not real. But I did walk around the area where the house is supposed to be located, and I chose a house that I thought was in the position that house would be in, but then I embellished it. And
does place help you with plot? So when you're walking around there and you're thinking about the place,
do you then have ideas about plot? Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, that particular area where Tideline's based is very... it's quite sort of spooky because there are lots of alleyways along the river. It's quite dark, especially obviously at night. It's not very well lit, and the tide's constantly coming in and out. And yeah, it just gives you ideas for sinister things that might happen. I don't want to give it's a bit of a spoiler if I say that something happens just outside the house on the wall that's just above the river. And you know, that idea came from looking.
The river's very important, isn't it, in lots of ways. Speaking of London, actually, sometimes, like it's planned, isn't it?
Almost.
Ruth Wade's latest novel, Foul Trade, is set in London. She's a creative writing tutor and coach. She writes under the name B.K. Duncan, and Foul Trade is the first novel in an historical crime series published by Oak Tree Press. It's set in 1920, and I asked Ruth what attracted her to that era.
The Great War, really, and the aftermath of the Great War. I think it was an incredibly difficult time to live through, and it was a time of great loss and discovery, but also there are a lot of parallels with now in terms of sociological and political parallels. And I think there's a lot of relevance to what we're going through today.
And I spoke to Anna Hope, whose novel Wake is set more or less in the same time, and she was saying that there were many opportunities for women, that women filled the spaces almost. Did you find that in your research?
Yes. Sometimes it was given with one hand and then taken away with the other. But there were more opportunities, and that was partly because there were fewer men because of the Great War. But it was also because women wanted to do something and they were no longer prepared to sit at home, wait to get married, have babies and do the domestic thing. They actually wanted to be involved in some way. Obviously, at the beginning of the war, when women were needed to drive trams for munitions and things like that, they were positively recruited, got a taste for it, and then didn't want to go back into the home.
Because your heroine, May Keep, she's a coroner's officer.
Yes.
Would that have been a common job, or is it quite unusual to find a woman in that position?
In my research, I haven't found that there was a woman, but there's no reason why there wouldn't have been. It wasn't a legally designated role, so the coroner could appoint anyone they wanted. And in fact, one of the real popular coroner's officers was their local undertaker. So she could have done it. She didn't need to have any medical or legal background at all. Plus the fact with fewer men around after the Great War, the chances are that someone working as a clerk would be promoted to also cover that role.
And you talk about research that's set in 1920 in a coroner's office in Poplar. You made it quite tough for yourself. That's three areas at least that you have to research.
I was in danger of just researching and researching and researching. I started with a lot of the facts, so I researched pathology and medical knowledge at the time via articles in Lancet, 1920 articles. I looked at coroner's reports in the Times newspaper and notable trials and the life of people in the dock. books and oral histories, the legal system, and all sorts of things. And of course, the more I learned, the less I felt I knew.
And some of the subjects you cover, like prostitution and drug dealing, did you feel that there was a parallel between today's London and the London of the 1920s? I mean, not dissimilar subjects that might be covered in a, you know, a gritty, seedy crime novel set in the present day.
Absolutely. Maybe for different reasons, though. It's always dangerous to generalise. Cocaine was taken very widely, not just by the flappers. I think there were primarily two reasons. One was recreational, as quite often now, but another one was about anaesthetising and trying to forget the loss and the misery and the poverty. And people were trying to escape to the best life that they could. Certainly around the docks, where drugs were imported, there were drug dealers on street corners all the time, and prostitution was rife because it was a way of earning a living.
How did it feel immersing yourself in that world?
Glad I wasn't a part of it, that's for sure. I felt a great empathy with particularly the women and how they had to struggle to make a life for themselves. And a lot of what we think we know about the 20s tends to be focused on the flappers and the aristocracy and country house parties and things like that. But the ordinary people had a really, really tough time. And as part of my research, I remember finding some photographs of, I think it was a Salvation Army woman going around to the houses, the slums really, of a lot of the poor people. And they were photographs that Dickens would have recognised. The poverty was appalling, and nobody was doing anything about it. That they had no power. The war had been fought, they'd been promised a better life, land fit for heroes, and they didn't get it. And it was the beginning of the seeds of the general strike and mass unemployment, etc. I found it fascinating. I also found it quite salutary as well.
And your book's dedicated to Oscar Kirk. Yes, Oscar. Tell me about him.
I was researching in the London Museum Docklands, and there was a journal from Oscar from 1919. And in 1918, at age 14, he became a messenger boy for the West India docks. He just wrote his journal. It was a lovely diary, and it contained all sorts of things, like what he had for tea and what the weather was like. I've got an extract. Would you like me to read it?
Yes, please.
Tuesday the 4th of February 1919. Went to the library and changed my library book and also Nana's. Strand for me and eternal love for Nana. Bought 2 halfpenny buns as I was coming home from the library. Wednesday 5th of February 1919. Had some fish for supper, cod. Read some of my library tonight. Had some chestnuts today out of the SS Rio. I found the chestnuts on the quay, but I didn't think I could be charged with stealing them as I found them. Had some soup for dinner at 5 p.m. Saturday, 8th of February, 1919. It is my half day today. Went London Bridge in the afternoon on an omnibus. I think that I've lost 6 pence out of my pocket, but Mother made it up for me. I bought jam and a ginger cake. Nana came this evening and made some chocolate, which turned out to be somewhat of a failure.
And I suppose all those little details that he's given you about what he's spending and what he's eating are just vital for you.
Oh, absolute gold. It was finding that diary that helped me to stop the research for everything else and stop going down all these tracks and thinking, I need to know more about the Port of London Authority or how brewery drays operated and the types of horses and all this sort of thing, because it just made me think, he's a boy and this is what was important to him. He also recorded things such as setting off some cordite cartridges that he'd bought and seeing divers in the docks and seeing dredgers and things. So it gave me a real taste and flavour. And if it was worth him noting, then it was worth me writing about.
And how is it when you're writing about real-life things that some things can't be changed and some things can? How do you decide which of those you're going to change?
I try very hard to honour the memories of the lives of the people that I've been reading about. So Oscar in this instance, but also the diaries and oral histories and memoirs. I couldn't make that up anyway, and I wouldn't want to, because they've written it, they've lived it. But I can put in the things that I don't know about, so their motivation for doing something, or how they felt about it, or what the repercussions were. So to take the incident and flesh it out as a real person, rather than taking something and then changing it, the more difficult thing was which bits to take in their entirety and which bits to leave out. So the bits that I put in from real life I tended to keep as it was, and I've got files and files and files of really interesting stuff that I want to use one day, but I couldn't fit in.
Well, is this the first of a series of novels?
Yes, it will be.
And how did you find plotting this novel? Because obviously it's a crime novel, the plot is very, very important.
Yes, difficult. I'm not a natural plotter. I do character, I do setting very well. Plots I have in the past, should we say, gone off on one. So I'll start with what is a good plot and then find something more interesting and move off and write something else in and lots of themes and things. So writing a crime novel forced me to really concentrate on the plot. And a lot of it was about structure. And I had a eureka moment when I realised how important structure was. I'm a creative writing teacher and I talk about structure all the time, but applying it to your own work is very different from understanding it intellectually. The plot helped me to develop the characters, I think, whereas in the past what I'd done is develop the characters and then had them acting a plot. So the discipline was good.
And coming out of that world in 1920, well, when you were writing, you must have been flipping between the two worlds. Does that world cast new light on the present day?
Yes. I think it makes me look very differently at our current disenchantment with politicians, because that was exactly the same then for very similar reasons. But I think it makes me realise how transitory everything is. I know that sounds obvious, and we're talking now, and now will be the history, you know, in 10 minutes' time, in 20 days' time or whatever. But I think focusing on the 20s, trying to imagine what it felt like for people actually living that life then without the luxury of hindsight, makes me think about what I do and my responsibilities as a citizen, as an ordinary human being, and what implications they may have for the future.
And you're writing as B.K. Duncan. Why did you choose a pseudonym?
I was talking with my agent on the day that I got the offer from the publisher, and I also write more literary novels, and we decided that it would be a wise thing to write under different names so that basically the publishers can segment the market. And I couldn't think of a name, and then Caroline, my agent, asked me what my mother's maiden name was, which is Duncan, so that seemed quite easy. And then I went off on one a bit and wanted to call myself Banquo Macbeth Duncan. But I got sensible and went for two Shakespearean strong female leads, Beatrice and Catherine. There's a fashion at the moment within crime writing for people to use initials. It isn't necessarily about hiding gender, because men do it as well. J.K. Rowling certainly made it very popular. And B.K. seemed quite snappy, something I might remember. So the full name is Beatrice Catherine, but B.K. is probably what I'd respond to.
To friends.
To friends, absolutely.
That's Ruth Wade there. As she says, writing as B.K. Duncan, her first novel, File Trade, is out now. I do recommend that, actually. It's a cracking read. Ruth was talking there about research, Penny. We've got Penny Hancock in the studio. It's and when to stop. And you can go on and on researching. Do you find that a problem?
I don't really, because I don't do very much research. I mean, I do what I need to do, but I think, as Ruth said there, you can get so bogged down in that you forget that you're writing a story, and I think the story has to come first. So I tend to try and leave any research until the last minute, when I need to kind of check things and make sure I've got things accurate. But I do the location. I do the sort of walking around the location. That's just more to get a sense of atmosphere than research.
And you said once that you were walking around a location and you actually came across a house that you ended up using in a novel. I mean, you peeped, if I may say, you peeped through the letterbox, is that right?
Oh, that was on a little blog, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't probably say, because somebody lives in that house. You know, what was weird about that was I had the house in my imagination, and I went to walk around the area where I imagined it was, and outside this beautiful crescent, there was a house, and outside there were some... they were selling some plants that they'd grown in the garden, some cuttings. And I thought, oh, they look nice. But you had to put the money through the letterbox for the cuttings. So I lifted the letterbox and I looked in and I thought, this is the house. This is exactly the house I was imagining. It was very bizarre. It was like seeing what I'd already had in my imagination. So in a sense, the idea came first and the reality came second.
And Ruth was talking there about her, you know, stumbling across journals and that kind of thing. I mean, is it ever appealing to you to set one of your stories in the past in that way?
I have thought about it. I think that sort of the work involved in researching, I really admire people who do that. I don't think it's my strength. I don't think it's something I would probably be able to do very with a lot of accuracy, because I would want to wander off and make things up. And as you said, you have to honour, if you're using real events and real people, you do have to honour what really happened. So I think I probably would steer away from that a little bit.
And what about honouring the characters that you create, or how you feel about your characters? I mean, you know, when you feel a character is, say, an aspect of yourself, is it then hard to do horrible things to them, or you know, to put them
or
in
to make them do horrible
things?
Yeah,
it's to make them do horrible things.
I didn't want. I know in Tideline, I mean, she does a terrible thing to start with. She captures this boy and she sort of invites him in and doesn't let him leave, and convinces herself at first that she's actually treating him, you know, giving him a bit of a sort of
special
holiday
time.
Almost. And then this leads to her to do worse, you know, to in order to keep him, she steps over another line and another one and another one. And I didn't really want to go down that far. I didn't want to go down that far at first, but somehow the story, it was the story that led me to cross that final line, to make her cross that final line. It sort of felt it, the story required it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it sort of depends. I found it uncomfortable, but
you sort of had to.
I sort
to
of
do
felt
it
worked in that particular story.
And do you have that? People talk about the characters taking over and it writing itself and all that kind of. Do you ever have that experience?
Yeah, in a way, that is what happens. I mean, once you've created this world and this scenario, and you're visiting it every day, and in fact, you're spending more time with that than you are in your real life. It does take over. It does begin to write itself a bit. I think. I mean. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always work. You know, it writes itself and then you might have to go and revisit it and rewrite. But, yeah, it does. I think the plot tends to take over.
Mm. Well, it's time for some more music now, I think. And we have got Beyoncé, Broken Hearted Girl next. Bit of a change of pace.
That's not my usual kind of thing. But the reason I chose this was Ellie. In my book, my new book is about a younger woman. And she's trying to get away from a relationship that's been holding her back, and the man she's been with is very into sort of real good sort of folky music. So she's driving down to her cottage she's just inherited and decides to play some pop.
This is Bookmark and we're in the studio today with novelist Penny Hancock. Penny, you're going to read to us from your new book, Trick of the Mind.
Yeah. Shall I explain the passage? Ellie's a 20, sort of 28-year-old woman who's become obsessed with the idea she's caused a hit and run on her journey down to her new cottage that she's inherited from her aunt. And she's gone to visit the victim in hospital, who she immediately finds very attractive. And she sort of becomes entangled in a web of lies, and we don't really know who's telling the truth. Anyway, at this point in the story, she's driving back from her cottage and wants to go and see her mother, who lives in Cambridge. So, it was 2 o'clock by the time I got in the car. It would be too late to do much work by the time I got home anyway, so I decided to do the detour I hadn't done last weekend to see my mother. She wrote about complex relationships. Maybe I could get some perspective from her about what was happening. And anyway, the teeth I'd found at Auntie May's had made me feel ill. Who was the little girl? Why did I feel as if I remembered her, yet when I tried to grasp where I'd seen her, she slipped out of my reach? She was the one whose name was on the gravestone. So what had happened to her? I would ask Mum to tell me about it. I was wary of taking the smaller, prettier country route since the hit and run. But it was light, no chance of half visions of possible victims of my driving. The countryside opened out as I got beyond Bury St Edmunds, flattened into large fields of rapeseed, lurid yellow to either side, and the sky grew wider and murkier. I was at the junction to Cambridge in just over an hour and a half, driving down its leafy streets, along the river, past Jesus Green, where students sprawled on the grass. My mother's house was in a narrow street off the road that ran along the river. I found a parking space, walked back down the terraced houses, negotiating my way between bikes propped up against the walls, blocking the narrow pavement. I knocked on the front door, which opened straight off the street, and when there was no answer, used my key. There was a vase of bluebells on the table in the front room. Mum? Her desk under the window was covered in heaps of papers and books. Photos of women cut out of magazines and chiselled, handsome men were pinned onto a notice board. My mother churned out 2 romantic novels a year, sometimes 3, and was in a constant state of anxiety that she wouldn't be able to come up with another complicated relationship to untangle in time for her deadline. I called out again. Hi, it's me. No answer. She wasn't here. I went upstairs, Pepper at my heels, to the little room in the back where I always slept when I came, and dumped my bag. I ran back down the stairs, Pepper behind me, turning around three times, performing my stupid rituals before I'd even realised I was doing it. I put the kettle on in her kitchen and strolled over to her desk. She'd scrawled notes above the photos on her board. Sabine begins affair with her sister Marcia's lover. Bella tries to attract attention of a sales assistant at the Apple store, to no avail. Hello? Mum came through the front door, her arms full of carrier bags, her hair, which was just greying, a little wild and unkempt, her brow furrowed. She looked older, and her face had thickened almost imperceptibly, but it gave me a tiny shock. Darling, I didn't know you were coming. Grab a couple of these bags for me, will you? I'm parched. Let's have a cup of something. You've been shopping. I had an appointment at the Apple store. The Apple store? They run free workshops. Been there all afternoon. And before you say anything, let me tell you, I bloody needed it. Why the Apple store? Shouldn't you be going to the gym or a therapist of some kind if you're feeling like this? No, I want hard knowledge. Apple men with clean fingernails. Apple men with their patience, explaining about Siri and how to download an app. They're what give me respite. Respite from what, though, Mum? From inner turmoil. They're so calm and cool and smooth-skinned and young, so sure. They do what they love and they know how to do it. You can go to as many workshops as you like and they never grow tired of showing you. Or maybe what I love is being taught again by people who have a greater knowledge than I do, yet who are so much younger, have so much future ahead of them. I find it rejuvenating. You sound like you've found religion. Actually, I sometimes do wonder if it's a kind of sect, but that's my imagination running away with me. The fact is, those hours in that clean room amongst handsome young men in blue shirts calms my mind. They don't flirt, though. I think it must be part of their training not to flirt with the women who come in to them in desperation. They listen and they offer solace and they have the patience of saints, but it is all strictly non-sexual, so in this respect, it's definitely safer than therapy.
Thank you, Penny. So, in this book, is it the first book that you've written about Cambridge?
Where Cambridge features. And it's how not really that, about Cambridge.
No, yeah. But Cambridge yeah. does appear yeah. in it. And how did that feel, including Cambridge in in your book?
How did it feel? It felt... I wanted to include Cambridge because I live near Cambridge mm-hmm. and it's so much part of my life. And also because the book's set between London and Southwold, Cambridge lies in between, so I thought that's the obvious place to have Ellie's mum living.
Well, someone who will be very pleased to hear that you have included Cambridge is Richard Reynolds, who is in charge of crime fiction at Heffers. I started by asking him how long he'd been there for.
Because I'm just about to begin my 34th year.
Wow.
And we set up the crime fiction section about 25 years ago, and it used to be housed, some of you might remember, on the below-the-waist shelves just by the ground floor stairs, and people had to be on their knees to get their crime fiction fix. So that was quite amusing in some ways, yeah. But I knew that soon complaints would roll in and we would be moved, so that's why I chose that spot to set it up.
And it's really grown, obviously.
Yes, hugely, yes. We're down to sort of three sort of areas now on the upper gallery, and it works very well indeed.
So when did you see it really start to take off, this fascination with crime fiction that we seem to have?
Well, I suppose it's always been there. We've always had the sort of Penguin crime classics that are always very popular. Everyone remembers the Green classics, and whenever we see them in a second-hand bookshop, we think, oh, have we got that one? And then march home and we've got a third copy of something. And I think it mostly started with those. And you sort of think of the great sort of stories of Marjorie Allingham and Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie, all the sort of Golden Age classics. And I think that... Maybe, I suppose, we started to have an event here in 1990 called Bodies in the Bookshop, And that's when we just saw more of an interest, not just for us, but around the country, I think. And you think in London, there was that great shop, Murder One, on Charing Cross Road, which sadly is not there now, which was, you know, really prompted a lot of people to sort of look at what was being published abroad as well. So that was great fun.
But, I mean, so in recent years, I mean, it's become a massive market. I mean, a real obsession, and so many more readers only want to read crime, and obviously the trends in Scandi and all that.
Yes,
kind of
yes,
thing.
Yes.
Why do you think we are so into crime?
Well, I think everyone likes to feel safe, don't they, when they finish reading one of these books. And on TV, yes, we can be horrified. It's the old sort of, not quite the Doctor Who scenario of being able to hide behind a cushion or behind the couch when you're watching something. And I think with the Scandi fiction on TV, that's worked very well indeed. And I think with The Killing, over such a long period, you know, 20 episodes, and yet we're drawn in it, we're almost addicted to it. And therefore, I think that's sort of shown the interest. And I think in the Stieg Larsson books, Henning Mankell, and then going back further, the books from the 1960s, the Martin Beck series, the Swedish crime writing duo, which I'm bound to mispronounce, is Svål and Walu. Tremendous series of 10 books, which I think started off that whole Scandi thing, but they came more to the fore, of course, with the Killing and things on TV.
And what about your own personal love of crime fiction? Where did that originate from?
Well, that began at my prep school when I read Dorothy Sayers. One of the teachers read something in the class at the end of term over a period of a week. And, OK, we didn't get to the end of the book, but it really just set that in motion, really. And it was The Nine Tailors, which isn't the easiest of books to access, really, in a way. And I suppose, really, I read lots of Agatha Christie, and not detective fiction, but sort of P.G. Woodhouse, with that sort of fun, sort of golden age sort of quality about it, and I just sort of progressed from there, really.
Do you think it ruins you for other kinds of fiction, because you get used to the thrills and
skills? Yes.
Yeah.
I know exactly, because yes, when you're reading a novel, you're waiting for someone to, through the door, and it can be a bit slow, but you've got, I started off, for my own benefit, really, a non-fiction reading group with some friends, really, because I was just aware that I wasn't reading enough non-fiction or just other kinds of fiction, and I wanted to be prompted into reading something monthly, which has sort of worked. We've only met about four times, but it has been really, really good, just to get us reading in other genre.
What about trends in crime writing? What have we got coming up, do you think? What are we going to move on from the Nordics and Scandis onto something else?
Well, there's a lot of good, you know, French crime fiction. We've got an author called Fred Vargas, who has been writing for some years now, and she's very, very successful, and she's got a really quirky detective in her, Inspector Adamsberg, eccentric, to say the least, and very, very accessible. And then, you know, you've got all the Maigrets, which are the Georges Simenon's books coming back into print with new translations, and one a month for the next sort of 70 months, which won't even be the tip of the iceberg, really, because, of course, he was such a prolific author. And lots of other upcoming sort of French writers. And then on TV, or no, on the radio, I think at the moment, you've got the Leon Padura books. They're not French, but a really good series on Radio 4 on Saturdays, serialised. So, you know, there's lots of good things coming up. But personally, I think, you know, someone like Louise Penny, who writes very well about Canada, small-town Canada, which is... It's not your Midsummer Murder territory, but a lot of people do die. But it's a very good series, and there have been 9 books so far. And tremendous, really, and you just grow with the characters in each book. You know.
Well, you've obviously read so much crime fiction yourself over the years. I mean, what do you think makes, you know, someone was thinking of writing on, what makes a really good crime novel? Is it the number of bodies? Is it the character, the detective?
I think sometimes it's the... not too much preamble at the beginning of the book.
The body on the first page.
Yes, really, in a sense, really, but not too violent. I think,
in
a sense, people like that sort of... Agatha Christie was so successful in sort of drawing people into her books. And I think also naturally, for us here, I'd like to have things set in Cambridge,
absolutely.
So that's really
that makes
key.
A good book. Yes.
you know, you've got a winner from the beginning.
That mainly leads me on to my next question, which is, Cambridge writers, Cambridge crime writers. Who are your favourite Cambridge crime writers?
Oh, dear. There's so many, really.
Yeah.
I mean, in Alison Bruce and her Gary Goodhue series works very well. We're doing very, very well with James Runcie at the moment, naturally, with the TV exposure and all that sort of thing. A lot of Golden Age crime writers, which have had a hand in bringing back into print, things like the Cambridge murders, Glyn Daniel, and there's also one by Adam Broome from the 1930s, for the Adam Broome and the Glyn Daniel is written 1948 but set in the 1930s, and we're just about to have that reissued in December, along with another book of his called Welcome Death, which is set partly here and partly in Wales. And then you've got the boat race murders, also the 1930s, by Swartout. And there's lots of those sort of Golden Age books as well. Bruce Dudley Edwards, who wrote a very good story called Matricide at St Martha's, which is a real dig at the colleges. That was written in the 1980s. And then you've got Michel Spring, good old story set at John's College. She wrote a series of books set in Cambridge. But only one is available at the moment. Emily Winslow, there's so many Kate Rose, and there's so many writers in Cambridge who are not necessarily setting their books here, although we sort of try to push them in that direction.
Yes, I know. Well, obviously, we love the fact there's so many writers in Cambridge. But you do quite a lot for them, don't you? You do these events, and tell us about what you do with Cambridge writers.
Well, we have an event called, we had an event for 22 years called Bodies in the Bookshop. And actually at Christmas this year, we're about to launch the Bodies in the Bookshop anthology, which 20 crime writers have submitted stories, partly set in Cambridge, some stories, a lot set in bookshops, one or two set in heifers. Lots of good old stories, really, and one or two ones that we've slipped in which don't quite fit the brief of bookshops or Cambridge, but just are there to just keep you on your toes, really, and it's great. And we're launching that on the 11th of December at our Heifer's Christmas Crime Party.
Fantastic. And I must also just ask you about you were the chair of the Gold Dagger Award. What does that involve?
Well, it really involves an awful lot of administration, to be honest. We have seven judges. Well, last year it was 193 books were submitted. And we announced our winner in October of this year, and the judging has already begun for next year. And just involves an awful lot of reading.
A lot of
deciding. And it's really great fun. And we've had more books in, I have to say, this time of year than we had this time last year, which is slightly worrying. So yes, and this year we chose Wiley Cash, an American writer, as our winner for The Dark Road to Mercy, which is a tremendous sort of road trip of a detective story. Quite short, but really a really good pacey read.
Well, some loads of recommendations there from Richard on crime fiction. He really knows his stuff. And their event is on December the 11th. If you love crime fiction, then go along to that. So it's 6:30 and it's a crime fiction party. I think we'll be trying to nip along to that, won't we, Lee?
Slim.
I asked Richard then, Penny, about whether reading crime fiction and thrillers had spoilt him for other kinds of fiction. And I wanted to ask you, because this latest book of yours is fantastically full of twists and turns. And have you become somewhat addicted to the genre, and has it spoilt you for other kinds of fiction?
It hasn't spoiled me for other kinds of fiction. I mean, I do read more than I used to of this kind of thing, of thrillers and crime. But no, I still read other genres as well.
But do you love the plotting and the making the reader go down one alley, and is that something that's become important to you?
I don't know. I still actually prefer books, even within the crime genre, that are very character based and where there's a slightly more literary element to them. I'm not keen on very plot driven books. I've tried, and I think they can be great page turners, and they can be really enjoyable. But I still seem to sort of be more drawn to books that go a little bit more deeper into the sort of areas of character. And
it's such a full genre, isn't it?
It covers so many things now, anyway.
And isn't it something like one in three books that are bought are crime novels? The appeal just doesn't seem to wane at all. It seems to be as popular as it always
is. But crime covers so many things now, and there's this argument as to whether books that are marketed under crime always are really crime, or whether they just... It's a useful label for publishers to use to sell. But, it's a huge genre, and it isn't just... It isn't just whodunits anymore at all, or gritty crime, or hard-boiled stuff as we sort of used to know it. It covers a much wider range of writing. And in fact, I've just read S.J. Watson's new book, The Proof, and it's very much more literary than his first one, even though it would still be classed as a crime thriller. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your books are beautifully written, but you manage to combine writing about place and character and bringing in the mystery. Where do you start? Do you have to sit down and plot them out, or do you start with character?
I think this whole question about whether you plot in advance, I mean, I don't really, because I feel as if, as we said earlier, the plots often sort of run away with you anyway. But I like to have a premise, quite a strong premise, and I usually like to have an ending. It's just the way I work. I really like to see where I'm going to sort of end up, so the ending for me isn't usually a surprise, but it's the journey, it's the getting from the initial problem or conundrum and the journey to this sort of following the story arc to where it's going to be resolved.
So you know the ending, but so you have to write it to find out what those twists are.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah, I do. And in fact, with this latest one, A Trick of the Mind, I did have quite a bit of help, because my initial idea was about this woman becoming obsessed with a hit and run and ending up going down a dark path and doing something even worse. And in fact, after several rewrites and discussions with my editor, it turned into a slightly different book that I think probably works better. But the plot twists that are in it now weren't there in the initial draft.
Mm-hmm. And you deal with some difficult issues in your books. I mean, you've got the older woman taking the young boy prisoner. In The Darkening Hour, you tackle the issue of migrant workers and this powerful woman sort of taking it. And in this book, you're looking at obsessive compulsive disorder. Do you feel like you need a meaty issue to get you
I quite like to have one. I mean, the obsessive compulsive, it wasn't really the big issue. It was just that I thought for a woman to become so obsessed that she'd done something that actually she obviously hadn't, she would have had to have a slight tendency to begin with. So that's why I sort of made her obsessive compulsive. But I'm interested. I mean, the migrant worker was just something that really interested me, the plight of migrant workers in this country and why they were being exploited, often behind closed doors in ordinary homes. So it just fascinated me.
Well, I think we could carry on talking to you for another hour probably, but unfortunately we're coming to the end of things now. You can tell us about our next show.
I will tell us about. Well, first of all, if you want to hear podcasts of any of our old shows, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, which is cambridge105.fm, and all the podcasts should be up there. In our next show, our studio guest is Helen Castor. She's author of the best-selling She-Wolves, and she'll be talking about her current book, A History of Joan of Arc. We've also got interviews with Tony Lenton. He's written a book about Edgar Speyer, who was accused of being a spy during World War I, and Jenny Ugler, who's written a book about life in Britain during the Napoleonic Wars. But we're going to finish this show, Penny, with your last choice of music, which is The Duke and the King, If You Ever Get Famous. Why have you chosen this?
For a start, in a way it relates to The Trick of the Mind, because Ellie's on a path where she thinks she's going to become famous, and then she's in conflict about it as a painter. But also it's just a song I love. My husband loves it, and it's for him.